says this: the essential thing in heaven and earth is that there should be a long obedience in the same direction. There, thereby, results and has always resulted in the long run something which has made life worth living. Coming from Friedrich Nietzsche, of all people, a long obedience in the same direction. And this idea, I think that he's on to something there that I think that we're sort of, in a way, rediscovering in our day and age that was forgotten, especially in my generation, where, you know, for me, born in 1971, a long time ago now, I grew up in the era of faster is better. We drank Tang because the astronauts did. We were always like so excited as kids to get TV dinners that came in these like foil things. We're like, oh my gosh, it's so quick. I remember when my grandma got the first microwave and you could like cook a hot dog in 30 seconds. So we just sat there cooking hot dogs like, this is incredible. I remember when my uncle, it was the first fax machine that I saw, and in his office he had two of them. And we just sat there like drawing pictures and sending them back and forth across the office. Like, I mean, technology was magic. Everything was immediate, and it's only gotten faster and faster with email. And then all of a sudden there was chat rooms. You could sit here and talk to somebody across the country, and then high-speed internet, and then eventually free two-day shipping from Amazon. Like, better, 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 except that now we're starting to sort of live in the aftershocks of that. And what you find is that, again, something that none of you are surprised by, we're more connected now than we've ever been, and yet loneliness and disconnection and anxiety seem to be at epidemic highs. That we have maximized efficiency, and in the end, it seems, lost something deeper, something more true, and in fact, maybe the thing that makes life worth living. It's interesting to see how in all our efficiency that even suicide rates go up. And something about Nietzsche's quote, I think, reflects a deep truth that somehow the thing of quality requires a measured slowness, that depth is found in an incremental process, an endurance over time. That the quick fix mentality that we were so in awe of has failed to provide in the end the depth, the excellence that we're all after. And yet I think we still wrestle with this idea. I think about my own kids and that desire in them to just be talented, right? We love talent, don't we love talent? I just want to be gifted. Meaning that, like, it's easy for me, it's effortless. And yet, as we talked about last week, the measure of success is now being discovered to be not in IQ or aptitude or intelligence, but in grit and endurance and an ability to stick to it. There was a book that came out a few years ago by Malcolm Gladwell called Outliers. Did anybody read this book? In this, he basically, his premise of the book is saying there's no mastery without 10,000 hours of work. He says this. He says, to become a chess grandmaster also seems to take about 10 years. Only the legendary Bobby Fischer got to that elite level in less than that amount of time. It took him 9 years. And what's 10 years? Well, it's roughly how long it takes to put in 10,000 hours of hard practice. 10,000 hours is the magic number of greatness. 10,000 hours seems to reflect this idea of a long obedience. He even says in the book, well, what about Mozart? Mozart was writing, he was composing when he was just a child. And Gladwell says, it's true, they just weren't any good. It takes time to build a mastery. It takes time to develop the things that ultimately in the end matter most. There's no quick fix to excellence. There's no shortcut to quality. And I think what James is telling us in his letter is that the spiritual life is ultimately no different. That there's a trajectory of salvation called sanctification. And in this, it's a road that we walk daily, plodding along through resistance, through suffering, through trial. But in the end, there's deep value, that there's a work that is being done. We're becoming stronger. We're becoming more pure of heart. In the end, we're becoming more and more like Christ. This is what discipleship means. That Jesus said, come follow me. Come take up your cross. Eugene Peterson, I don't have the quote for this up there, but he says, there's a great market for religious experience in our world. There's little enthusiasm for the patient acquisition of virtue, little inclination to sign up for a long apprenticeship in what earlier generations of Christians called holiness. Last week, we looked at this passage in James where he says, count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. This idea of perfection and completion, I think sometimes it's not even really in our gospel message. I grew up in the area of evangelism where we had it like boiled down to a track, four spiritual laws. Boom, boom, boom. Here's the question. Are you in or are you out? And you know what? I saw so much good fruit come from that. So it's not to diminish that there are tools for sharing our faith. But I think sometimes we take this as a like simple yes and no and don't equip people for the road to be walked. As Chesterton says, it's not that Christianity has been tried and found lacking. It's that it's been found difficult and left untried. As Peterson talks about the attrition, I think sometimes we've set it up as simpler than it is. And James comes in and says, look, you guys, it's a hard road. And yet at the same time, the work that it is doing in your hearts is having an eternal effect. There's a value to what is going on where you are becoming not just healed and healthy, but like Christ, like your rabbi. You are following in the footsteps of your teacher, becoming like him. We talked about a little bit last week when rabbis would come and find disciples. They would say, follow me. And what that meant was, you have what it takes to do what I do. And as Jesus comes to us, that is the offer. Follow me, come do what I do. Which is sobering because it involves a cross. And sometimes I think we forget that cost in all of it. That grace, as powerful as grace is, was not cheaply bought. Dietrich Bonhoeffer says this, and I think this is really good. He's saying, cheap grace, that's like the shortcut, that's the quick fix, is the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance, baptism without church discipline, communion without confession, absolution without personal confession. Cheap grace is grace without discipleship, grace without the cross, grace without Jesus living and incarnate. And this is not to create some sort of heavy-handed thing. It's just looking at the human condition and seeing it for all that it is. But also having vision for just how far God thinks that we can go. You know that I love that verse where God is going to say to Jeremiah, if you're stumbling, racing against men, how will you run against horses? That we have a God who sees us as so much faster than we see ourselves. Paul says this in Colossians 3. Since then you've been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. For you died and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. And the journey of discipleship is a lifetime journey, ultimately ending in glory. That this is your trajectory. This is the journey that you're on. And in the end, as difficult as it might be, there's a work going on that is making you whole and complete. This is God's school of love, and it's teaching you to love like Jesus loved. And what I love in this verse, and I think this coincides James and Paul, who kind of butt heads a little bit in their ministry time together, but I think they end up giving us kind of two sides of the same coin. But I think what Paul is getting at when he says, set your minds on things above, this discipline becomes one of our greatest areas of freedom. I like how Jay was saying, hey, we're going into this year, it's going to be a great year, and how you think about it matters. Becomes one of our greatest freedoms, what we think about, how we set our minds on this. As James says, consider it joy when you face trials. Because if you're like me, you don't, naturally. That's not your knee-jerk response. When you're inconvenienced or something difficult happens, how many of you go, oh, goody. If you're like me, your natural response to trials, like, are you kidding me? Right? Like, really? This? Okay, I've got to deal with this now? And James is going, oh, no, this is opportunity. Somebody just showed me a quote the other day from Billie Jean King where she said, pressure is privilege. Have you heard that? And I was like, oh, gosh, I don't even know the context. I just remember thinking, oh, that sounds like James. Oh, I feel so much pressure. It's privilege. You're being asked to step up. But God is sitting there, your teacher, and he's giving you assignment, and you're going, this is too hard. And he's like, it's not too hard. You can do it. You have what it takes to do this. And it's not us on our own. James is clear about that. It's through help we ask for wisdom. In fact, that's where the power is. Not in us taking control of this, but the willful surrendering of our posture and allowing God to help us become it. It's a yieldedness. And as we yield to the trials, as we learn to reframe them, to consider them joy, it takes a reminding, right? This is the exercise of our will. This is posture of surrender. When we come into trials, we're like, dang it, and we want to resist and we want to push back. And he's saying, no. Like, smile, breathe, ask for help. God, give me wisdom. Give me discernment. As you do, you will become more and more complete. And what James tells us in our passage today is, in fact, this is where the good life occurs, is in the midst of this, in the midst of the trial, in the midst of the difficulty. And in verse 12, he said, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. For when he stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. There's a couple things in here that I think are so important. The interesting thing, one of those things that sort of gets lost in translation, is that trial and temptation are actually in the Greek the same word, perasmos, that are English translators have helped us, I think, understand the nuance. And I think rightly so. It's nice for us to be able to see trial and temptation. But James uses those words interchangeably. And I think that there's actually a help in seeing, from James's perspective, the paradox. What is this? Is this a trial Or is this a temptation? The answer is yes. That it's a trial because it brings opportunity, but it's a temptation because it comes with a snare. That there's something cunning in these things, that James is going to be clear, preys on where we are weak. And to understand this, these trials, there's a danger in it. There's a cunning to these temptations when they come. And he doesn't mention right here in this passage, but will, that there's an enemy that knows where you're weak. Isn't that kind of ominous? I remember this, you know, we'll deal with some of this a little bit later, but I remember being in a class, a theology class, we were talking about this idea of a spiritual realm. And somebody asked the question, how can you tell the difference between something demonic and something that's just like a sort of mental disorder? And my teacher said this, and I'll never forget it. He said, oh, when you're dealing with something demonic, there's information coming at you that that person has no business knowing. Right? Is that? Like somebody's reading your mail. Somebody knows your like internet search history, right? And I think sometimes we live our life with this sense of being so hidden. We're able to hide from each other. We're able to diminish those areas of weakness. What we find is in a spiritual realm, all that's there and on display. So when those snares come, do you think they hit you where you're strong? No, they hit you where you're weak. And I think James knows here in this passage about our tendency to, number one, diminish our weakness, number two, to not take responsibility for it, to even maybe blame God when we're tempted or we're going through trial. We go, God, where are you? And James goes, no, 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 this is on you. This is on your heart and the things going on. When we talk about being made perfect and complete, we're talking about parts of us that need to heal. And those parts in us that need to heal probably need to die. The things that love to worship ourselves, insist on our elevation at another's diminishing, that hoard and are jealous and greedy. That sort of thing in us is the thing that needs to be treated with chemo. It's cancer. And you see how James is saying, just as much as there is a spiritual trajectory for you to reach maturity, sin in a similar way, if left unchecked, reaches maturity. It grows, it develops, and it grows more and more rigid. It has a way of desensitizing us. And all of us have experienced this, right? Where those things that once bothered us no longer do. We get kind of numb to it. It's like watching television, right? What was shocking 10 years ago is no longer shocking. Some of it's still shocking. But the fact is that sin has a sort of numbing. It erodes that part of our will that's free and able to choose what we think about. So Scripture says, look, when that sin is having its effect, it's not like you can deal with these things in isolation, that when it comes into you, it's potentially changing you, hardening you. But the blessed life is the resistance of this, to see the joy to welcome God's treatment, which is why I think God allows the temptation. He allows it. And this is something that can be a point of confusion for us. I don't know if there's a harder verse. I mean, there's probably more harder verses than this, but one of them is in Job, where God says to the devil, have you considered my servant Job? Like, please, God, don't say that. Have you considered my servant Jeff? There's another part where Jesus says to Peter, Satan's asked to sift you like wheat. And yet what you see is, I think, God allowing these things to come in, because he's going, in that struggle creates opportunity for us to lean on God, and as we do, to become wise. But James is showing us, look, it requires responsibility that we look at ourselves and we don't diminish where we're weak, but we invite God into that. And that's hard for us to do. Because where we're weak, these are things that we would just not naturally share. You know, you're like putting your finger on it when you like start to sweat. You know what I'm talking about? Those things about us that you go, oh, this is hard to admit, but this is me. And again, when we do that, I think we take responsibility, but what we do is we bring it into the light. And God is saying, show me. I want you to show me. Let me in there. And so often we've got our closets, the rooms in the house where we're like, God, come on in, stay out of that room. But the more we can allow God to come in, to own that, the quicker we heal. The more we avoid it, the more we do damage to our ability to generously love. I love this quote from Brené Brown. I'm a fan of hers. She says, shame, blame, disrespect, betrayal, and the withholding of affection damage the roots from which love grows. Love can only survive these injuries if they are acknowledged, healed, and rare. Catch ourselves when we're in these patterns of blame, withholding affection. All of these are symptoms of something deeper. And God is coming in and he's going, no, I want you to have freedom there. And the blessed life, the good life, is always this life of freedom, but freedom from the self-worship, freedom from the things that come in and twist us and corrupt us, that allow us to flourish. And that flourishing is always that sense of generosity, of giving away the divine that's been given to us, that comes in and goes out. And God has always said, this is what it means to be the blessed people, that you are the conduit of the blessing. To live like this is to become wise. To live like this is to become mature and complete. It's the journey that we're on. Now, I want to back up just a second to the last thing, because my wife sort of called me out on this last week. She said, you know, in the last, it's saying, in order for this to have this wisdom, you have to believe and not doubt. The one who doubts is like the wave of the sea driven and tossed. And Patty said, isn't doubt like kind of your thing, Jeff? I was like, no. I was like, I totally appreciate it, actually, what she's saying, because I think that sometimes when we think considerate joy, it's like just like have this resolute confidence at all times. God will give you wisdom, but you can't falter at all. You can't disbelieve. And I'm here to tell you that I think that is absolutely not true. I think that's unbiblical. I think that's not what James is saying here. That faith happens in the midst of that crisis, but that faith endures in the midst of the question. All you have to do is read the Psalms. And this is David's heart again and again. Listen to this. In Psalm 13, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Consider and answer me, O Lord, my God. Light up my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death, lest my enemies say I have prevailed over him, lest my foes rejoice because I'm shaken. And here you see David in all the turmoil, right? I love how, hang on, go back just a sec. I love how Walter Brueggemann says that the Psalms so often, they take us through what he would call disorder. We come into these places of the questions, and James is saying, have faith. But what does he mean? He's not saying don't have questions. He's saying this. So next verse is the reorder in Psalm 13. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing the Lord's praise, for he has been good to me. That's faith, right? The faith that comes in that moment of crisis and realizes the tendency to want to turn around, to go backward, to cling to the old ways, to go back to where those old places of comfort, those old places of control. You say, no. Remember this, that God is good. God is steadfast. That even in the midst of the darkness, that who God is remains unchanging and the same. To see past our circumstance. And this is part of what Paul is telling us to do when he says, set your minds on things above. As we start to lose heart, right? He's saying, fix your gaze further. Don't get caught up in the immediate. Keep your gaze long. Keep your vision on what ultimately matters. I like how Kierkegaard says, purity of heart is to will one thing. And this is what we find, I think, in this. We talk about what has been referred to as prayers of indifference. And how these prayers of indifference are like the ultimate test of the will. It's Mary saying, let it be done to me according to your word. It's Jesus on the cross saying, not my will, but your will be done. This is endurance. That is faith. That's what we practice. And as the trial comes up and as those fears come up in us, we see what still needs to be healed. But rather than growing dismayed, we realize this is where the challenge is. This is where, James would say, is the opportunity. Consider it joy that this is the area where God is calling you to become larger. I don't know if we really have time for this, but I'm going to throw it up there quickly anyways, because this is from The Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis. He says this. James says, look, the trial, it's not God tempting you. And this, I like this because I think it's so simple and so helpful that he's going, you have these things in life. He says, in the fallen and partially redeemed universe, we may distinguish one, simple good descending from God. That's God's wisdom that comes to us. God's revelation, God's love. But two, the simple evil produced by rebellious creatures. James is going, that's the stuff, the evil desires that are in us, the things that are cruel or selfish or small. But I love the wording of this. I just think this is so Lewis. He says, number three, the exploitation of that evil by God for his redemptive purpose, which produces, number four, the complex good to which accepted suffering and repented sin contribute. This is what I think is so great. Lewis goes on to say, the cross is the ultimate picture of complex good. All the evil thrown at it. And the resurrection is this triumph, as he puts it, the exploitation of the evil for God's purposes. That's the confidence that we have when we face trial. And so when we look at things that are wrong or we suffer things that shouldn't have happened, I think it is safe to say these things are wrong. These things are evil, especially when we're talking about abuse or cruelty, things that we've experienced. Even those things, God is saying, trust me, I will have the last word. Trust me, even those things can be exploited of their strength and used for the sake of your greater good. Those things ultimately in the end will form you to have a heart and mind like Christ. James says in verse 16, do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. Of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Love that song that we sang, your good father, it's who you are, and I'm loved by you, that's who I am. These are like basic identity statements, that sometimes it's that simple. We need to hold on to those truths. When life becomes difficult or we find ourselves in the valley of the shadow of death and we go, God, where are you? As David cries out. And as we see in the psalm, you go, oh, you are steadfast love. You are unchanging. You are a good father. And who am I? I'm loved by you. In 1 John 4:18, it says, there's no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not been perfected in love. And in this idea of like the love of the Father and seeing our identity rooted in that, all of a sudden the fear and anxiety that boils to the surface reminds us that our vision has become too nearsighted, too myopic. We're being encouraged to see beyond that to who God's true heart is. There's a phrase that I like. I think I heard Richard Rohr use it first. He says, there's this deep okayness in life. Is that good? It reminds me of Julian of Norwich. There's a line that she heard from God just saying, all shall be well. All shall be well. And every manner of thing shall be well. That when we hold to that, it gives us strength. We endure. We remain steadfast in the midst of the trial. That is the texture of faith. The writer of Hebrews says, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so you will not grow weary and lose heart. I think of this sometimes when I feel like I'm suffering unjustly and I'm praying that to God, like, God, this is not fair. And I feel like sometimes God will go, I know it hurts, huh? And I think, oh yeah, that's right, you get this. So much more than I ever will. All of a sudden, my problems compared to the weight of the cross, and I just go, oh, help me. We fix our eyes on Christ, who models love. And the image that this brings up as we kind of bring this to a close, I think of Peter. And I think of how much Peter wanted to just be the rock. And how it was failure after failure that seemed to teach him the truth, that he would never be able to do this without Christ. I love that example of him stepping out of the boat in the midst of the storm. So brave, the only disciple that was able to like get out there on the water, and yet the circumstance become too much and he sinks. And you have Jesus just reach out and help him back up. And here's the truth of this. This is hard, and we're gonna sink. We just are. We're gonna lose heart. We're gonna fall under. And Jesus is gonna come back and reach and pick us up. But he's gonna remind us, keep looking at me. I'm the source of your wisdom and your strength. Stop trying to do this on your own. Or in Paul's words, I can do all this through him who gives me strength. There becomes the truth that we cling to. And as we do, we finish this course. And as James says, we receive this crown of life, not to elevate us above somebody else, but instead a sense of completion to know that you have run the course set before you. This is how we finish well. I have some questions for you, of course. Number one, I think we should all just begin there. Do you know where you're vulnerable? Like really vulnerable? Like if you were going to attack you, where would you attack? Do you have someone in your life you would trust to help you see your blind spots? If you think that you are comfortable living in like sort of truth and transparency, just go ask a dear friend, what are my blind spots? Right? Does that terrify you? Terrifies me. And yet that truth, how incredibly helpful. Number two, how are the trials and temptations you're facing giving you the opportunity for victory and growth? That little reframing. What would it be like to have freedom from the things that are tempting you? And when we experience that freedom, you know what it feels like? Not like victory so much as those things become small as we grow. that they just sort of brush off. Those things that seem so ominous or overwhelming all of a sudden are seen for what they really are. Little yapping dogs. Number three, what practices would help you discipline your mind and heart to keep your focus on Christ and his kingdom? Are there things you need to cut out that are causing too much distraction? And this is where that double-mindedness, if we are trying to keep a foot into both these worlds, in the end, it will just frustrate us. It keeps our minds burdened, and we keep falling back into those old patterns. What are the things that can be left aside so that we can finish our race? The sin that entangles us, that can be set behind us so that it no longer distracts. To bring those questions to God, I think these are questions that delight God's heart. As we say, God, I want to run this race. God, help me to grow in wisdom and endurance. Help me to be more and more like your Son.